Yes, but it's still a supporting part. Detlef Sierck, the playwright, is taking the leading role, the young Prince Oswald.
Lowenstein's patron chuckled, a sound like a machine rasping. Young Prince Oswald. Yes, how apt, how thoroughly apt. Lowenstein was conscious of the lateness of the hour. He had to be at the palace early tomorrow, to be fitted by Kereth the cobbler with his leather iron outfit. He was tired. And you play?
Drachenfels.
The chuckle came again. Ah, yes, the man in the iron mask. That must be uncomfortable, don't you think? An iron mask? The actor nodded, and the man in the mask laughed outright.
What do?
Come on now, Laszlo, spit it out.
What do you want of me?
Why, nothing, my friend. Just to congratulate you, and to remind you of your old attachments. I hope you shan't forget your friends as you achieve the fame you so richly deserve. No, I hope you shan't forget. Something small was crying softly in the next room. It bleated like a goat. Lowenstein felt the uncertain stirrings of his old desires. The desires that had led him to his nomadic life, that had made him a wanderer from city to city. Always cities, never towns, villages. He needed a population large enough to hide in. But he needed to hide while putting his face before audiences every night. It was not an easy situation. Without his mysterious patron, he'd have been dead 7 times over. Lowenstein controlled himself.
I don't forget.
Good. You've enjoyed your wine, I trust. The crying was quite loud now, not like a goat or a lamb at all. Lowenstein knew what awaited him next. He wasn't as tired as he had thought. He nodded his head to his patron's question.
Excellent. I like a man who enjoys his pleasures, who relishes the finer things in life. I enjoy rewarding them. Over the years, I've greatly enjoyed rewarding you.
He got up and opened a door. The room beyond was lit by a single candle. The thing that cried was tied to a cot. On a table beside it were laid out a trayful of shining silver implements, such as Kereth the cobbler might have, or one of the barber surgeons in Ingoldstrasse. Lowenstein's palms were slick now, and his nails dug into them. He finished his wine with indecent haste, wiping a trickle from his chin. Trembling, he got up and walked into the other room.
Laszlo, your pleasure awaits you.
10. Detlef was discussing sets with Crown Prince Oswald's architects. The Crown Prince had managed to arrange for the purchase of the actual fortress of Drachenfels, with the intention of staging the play in its great hall. The advantages were obvious, but so were the drawbacks. Some parts of the castle would have to be restored to their original condition, and others remade as dressing rooms, scenery docks, and actors' quarters. A stage would be built in the great hall. Initially, Detlef was tempted by the idea of having the play take place in real time, with the audience tagging along after the characters as they made their way to the fortress and then penetrated its interior. But the scheme was too reminiscent of the history of Sigmar for Oswald to authorise. Besides, while the audience would be few enough in number, only the most important citizens of the Empire would be privileged to attend the performance, they were not likely to be in the first bloom of youth. It would be difficult enough to transport the creaky and antique dignitaries to the fortress by the gently sloping road that had been impassable and demon-haunted in Oswald's days, let alone the vertiginous path the adventurers had taken. Even if Detlef's caste could brave the perils, It would be likely that some high priest or Lord Chamberlain would take a nasty tumble from the sheer cliffs on top of which the fortress stood. This would be the crowning achievement of his career, this single performance. But all the while, Detlef was planning to prepare a less lavish version of his text, more suited to ordinary theatres. He saw no reason why Drachenfels shouldn't enter the repertoire of every company in the Empire, on the condition that substantial royalties were paid him. He already had Guglielmo putting out feelers for a theatre in Altdorf where the play could have a good run after its much-publicised premiere. There was already much interest, with the involvement of the Crown Prince doing a good deal to offset Detlef's bad reputation. Detlef was waiting for a good bid from a house which would let him stage his play by his own lights and take the central role himself. Currently he favoured Anselmo's on Breikstrasse, but the more experimental Temple of Drama was running a close second. Anselmo's was just a bit too wrapped up in regurgitating 200-year-old productions of Taradash's lesser works for the burghers and merchants who came to Altdorf and felt that they had to snore through a play while in the city. Detlef glanced over the architect's sketches and put his initials to them. He was satisfied with their suggestions, although he would have to go himself to Castle Drachenfels before making any final decisions. After all, it should be safe now. The great enchanter had been dead for 25 years.
Detlef! Detlef, a problem!
It was Varga Bruegel, waddling into Detlef's chambers with his usual perpetual expression of anxiety. It was always a problem. The whole art of drama was nothing but a succession of problems solved, ignored, or avoided.
What now? Detlef sighed.
It's the role of Menesh.
I thought I'd told you to settle with Gesualdo. I trust you in matters dwarfish, you know. You ought to be an expert.
Bruegel shifted on his feet. He was not a true dwarf, but the stunted offspring of human parents. Detlef wondered if his trusted lieutenant didn't have a touch of the warpstone in his nature. A lot of people in the theatrical profession had an iota or two of chaos in their makeup. Detlef himself had had an extra little toe on his left foot, which his lamented father had personally amputated.
"There's been some controversy over your selection of the Tylean jester for the part," said Bruegel, waving a long curl of paper covered in blotty signatures. "Word got out, and some of the dwarfs of Altdorf are presenting this petition. They're protesting against the representation of all dwarfs on the stage as comic relief. Menesh was a great hero to the dwarfs."
"And what about Yuli the Traitor? Is he a great hero to the dwarfs?"
"Yuli wasn't a real dwarf, as you well know."
"He's also not likely to be the source of much comic relief, is he? I can't think of many stab-in-the-back gags."
Bruegel looked exasperated.
"We can't afford to upset the dwarfs, Detlef. Too many of them work in the theatre. You don't want a scene shifter's strike. Personally, I hate the smug bastards. Do you know what it's like being turned out of taverns for being a dwarf when you aren't one, and then being turned out of dwarf taverns for not being a real dwarf?"
"I'm sorry, my friend. I wasn't thinking."
Bruegel calmed down a little. Detlef looked at the illegible petition.
"Just tell them I promise not to make any unwarranted fun of Menesh. Look here, I'm making some cuts."
Detlef tore up some already discarded pages. Accidentally, the petition was among them.
"There. No more short jokes. Satisfied?"
"Well, there's another objection to Gesualdo."
Detlef thumped his desk.
"What now? Don't they know that geniuses need peace of mind to create?"
"It's the one-armed dwarf actor we saw. He's insisting he have the role, that he's the only one who can play the part."
"But Menesh only gets his arm torn off at the very end.
I admit we could do some clever trickery with a fake limb full of pig's guts and have a convincing horror scene, but he'd never be able to go through the whole drama without the audience noticing the stiff and inactive hand. Besides, the fool was at least 20 years too old for the part.
Bruegel snorted.
He would be, Detlef. He's the real Manesh.
11. The prisoner was going to make an escape attempt. Anton Veit could see Erno the burglar tensing himself for the breakaway. They were only 3 streets away from the townhouse of Lord Leidenbrock, the citizen who had posted reward on the man. Once Veit dropped his charge off and collected his bounty, Leidenbrock would be free to do whatever he wanted to get his property. 20 gold crowns, some jewels belonging to the Countess, and a gilded icon of Ulrich. Back. And since the thief had fenced the merchandise in another town and drunk away all the money, Leidenbrock would probably turn his mind towards extracting repayment in fingernails or eyes, rather than more common currency. The Lord had a reputation for severity. If he hadn't, he would have hardly employed Veit. The bounty hunter could tell precisely when Erno would make his run for freedom. He saw the alleyway coming 100 yards away and knew his man would try to duck into it, hoping to outdistance Veit and find some willing blacksmith to get the chains off his arms and legs. He must think the old man wouldn't be able to run after him. And of course, he was right. In his youth, Veit might have raced after Erno and brought him down with a tackle. But then again, he would more likely have done exactly what he was going to have to do now.
Veit, said the burglar, couldn't we come to some arrangement?
Here was the alley.
Couldn't we?
Erno swung his chains at the bounty hunter. Veit stepped back out of range. The burglar pushed aside a fat woman nursing a child. The baby started bawling, and the woman was in Veit's way.
Get down,
he shouted, drawing his dart pistol. The woman was stupid. He had to shove her aside and take aim. The child was squealing like a roasting pig now. The alleyway was narrow and straight. Erno couldn't weave from side to side. He slipped on some garbage and fell, chains tangling about him. He rose again and ran, reaching for a low wall. Sharply conscious of the pain in his twice-broken, twice-set wrist, Veit brought his pistol up and fired. The dart took Erno in the back of the neck, lifted him off his feet, and brought him down in a heap of limbs and chains amid the filth of the gutter. Evidently, the alley was used mainly by the inhabitants of the upper stories of the adjacent houses as a receptacle for their wastes. The stones were thickly grimed, and a smell of dead fish and rotting vegetables hung like a miasma in the air. Veit had been trying for the thighs. That should have brought Erno down, but kept him breathing. The money was the same, dead or alive, but now he would have to haul the deadweight carcass to Leidenbrock's house, and he was breathing hard already. He leaned against a slimy wall and fought for breath. A physician had told him that something was eating him up from the inside, a sickness that might be the result of his lifelong addiction to the strong cigars of Araby.
It's like a black crab feeding inside you, Veit, the man had said, and it'll kill you in the end.
Veit didn't mind. Everybody died. If it came to a life without cigars, or death with them, he'd not have hesitated about his choice. He took out a cigar now, and his tinderbox. He drew in a double lungful of smoke, and had a coughing fit. He hawked black, ropey phlegm, and made his way down the alley, steadying himself against the walls. Erno was dead, of course. Veit pulled out his dart and wiped it clean on the corpse's rags. He reloaded the pistol, setting the spring and the safety catch. Then he unlocked the chains and slung them over his shoulder. Chains were an expensive item in his line of work. He'd been using these, forged especially by dwarf blacksmiths, for over 10 years. They were good chains,
and had kept far more dangerous men than Erno in his custody. He took the dead man by his bare feet, he'd sold the boots after chaining him up, and dragged him back to the street. As he pulled, there were sharp pains in his chest. The black crab was settling on his ribs, he thought, eating away at the muscles holding bone together, and now his skeleton was grinding itself to dirt inside him. It wouldn't be much longer before he collapsed, like a jellyfish, useless to himself. His aim wasn't so good these days either. Good enough, he supposed, but he used to be a champion shot. When bounty hunting had been slow, he'd been able to pick up extra income for winning contests. Longbow, crossbow, pistol, throwing knife, he'd been the best with them all. And how he'd taken care of his weapons. Each was honed to the perfect sharpness, oiled, if need be, polished, and ready to kiss blood. He still tried to keep up, but sometimes things were more difficult for him than they had been. 25 years ago, briefly, he had been a hero. But fame passes quickly, and his part in the downfall of Drachenfels had been minor enough to be overlooked by most balladeers. That's why he had allowed Joachim Munchberger to publish Veit's own account as a book. The mountebank had disappeared with all the profits, and it had taken him some years, working between jobs, to track him down and extract payment. Munchberger must have had to learn to write with his left hand. Now the whole thing was about to start up again. Crown Prince Oswald's emissaries had found him and asked him to come forward and talk to a fat actor for some new version of the tale. Veit would have refused, but money was offered. And so soon he would have to go through the whole dull story again for this Detlef Seok, a runaway debtor himself by all accounts, and again be overlooked, while young Oswald luxuriated in the golden glow of glory. Oswald. He had come a long way down the road since his days as a snot-nosed boy. Soon he'd be picking his first emperor. While blubber-bellied Rudy Wagner was drowning himself in gin, crazy Erzbet was raving in some cell, and Lady Eternity was gorging herself on virgin's blood. And Anton Veit was where he'd always been, out on the streets, searching for the wanted and unwanted criminals, converting the guilty into crowns. Oswald was welcome to his position. Erno was getting heavier. Veit had to sit down in the street and rest. A crowd gathered around him as he watched over his goods, but soon went away again. Flies were buzzing about the dead man's face, crawling into his open mouth and nostrils. Veit hadn't the strength to shoo them away. So, haloed by insects, the two proceeded together towards the house of the fine gentleman. 12. Detlef woke up to find himself face down in a sea of manuscript pages. He had fallen asleep at his desk. By the clock, it was 3 in the morning. The palace was cold and quiet. His candle had burned low, spilling wax onto the desk, but the flame still burned. Sitting upright, he felt the dull throbbing in his head that always came with periods of extreme overwork. Sherry would help. He always had some nearby. He pushed his chair back and took a bottle from the cabinet near the desk. He swigged a mouthful from the bottle, then poured himself a glass. It was fine stuff, like all the luxuries of the von Königswald palace. He rubbed together his chilled hands to get the warmth back into them. He ordered the pages on the desk, shuffling them together. His working text was nearly complete. All the alterations prompted by his interviews with Rudy Wagner, Manesh the dwarf and the crown prince were penciled in, and he doubted whether the testimony of the bounty hunter Veit or the vampire lady Dudonne would make much difference. Research was the skeleton of the play, but the flesh on it was all Detlef Seok's. His audience would expect no less. Oswald had even encouraged him to depart from history at a few points, the better to reach the truth of the matter. Would that all patrons were as enlightened in the matter of artistic license.
his headache began to fade, and he reread a few pages. He had been working on his curtain speech, the summation of the drama, when he had fallen asleep, and an ink trail scratched across the bottom of the last sheet of paper. He'd blotted his soliloquy with his cheek, and guessed the ink would be dried in by now. He must look a fool. His own words still moved him. He knew only he could do justice to such a speech. Only he could convey the triumph of good over evil without falling into bathos or melodrama. Strong men would weep as Detlef, as Oswald, spoke over his fallen foe, finding at last a touch of sorrow for the ending of even a life such as Drachenfels had led. He had planned to have Huberman underscore the scene with a solo gamba, but now he decided that the music wouldn't be necessary. The lone voice, the stirring words, would be enough. "Let joyful towers a tintinnabulation sound, that the enchanter great is under good ground. And let the infernal churches sound their bells to welcome Constant Drachenfels." Outside the window lay the grounds of the palace, and beyond them the sleeping city. There was a full moon, and he could see the immaculately laid out lawns as if in a monochrome etching. The Crown Prince's ancestors, the previous electors of Ursland, stood in a row on pedestals, seeming staid and monolithic. Old Maximilian was there, in his younger days, waving a sword for the Empire. Detlef had seen the current elector being assisted about the place by his nurses, blathering to all who would listen about the great old days. Everyone in the household knew the time of Maximilian was drawing to an end, and that the days of Oswald would soon be beginning. The architects Oswald had engaged to assist in the settings for the play were also planning to remodel some of the palace. More and more, the Crown Prince was taking over the business of the von Königswalds. He spent most of his days closeted with high priests, chancellors, imperial envoys and officials of the court. The succession should be smooth. And Detlef's Drachenfels would mark the start of the Oswaldian era. An artist is not always set aside from the course of history, he supposed. Sometimes an artist could as much make history as a general, an emperor, or an elector. He scratched his moustache and drank more sherry, savouring the quiet of the palace by night. It was so long since he had known sustained quiet. The nights of Munzen Keep had been filled with terrible groans, the screams of those who slept badly, and the incessant drip of the wet walls and ceilings. And his days now were a total cacophony of voices and problems. He had to interview actors and the leftovers of Oswald's adventurers. He had to argue with those too hidebound to see how to convert his ideas into actuality. He had to put up with the shrill complaints and the nauseating cooing of Lily Nissen. And, through it all, there was the clumping of booted feet on wood as actors stamped through rehearsals, the hammerings of the workmen constructing devices for the play, and the clatter of the cast members learning to fence for the fight scenes. Most of all, there was Bruegel, always roaring, "Detlef! Detlef! A problem! A problem!" Sometimes he asked himself why he had chosen the theatre as an outlet for his genius. Then he remembered. There was nothing to compare it with. A cold hand caressed his heart. Out there in the gardens, things were moving. Moving in the shadows of the elector's statues. Detlef wondered if he should raise the alarm. But something suggested to him that these shapes were not assassins or robbers. There was an unearthly languor to their movements, and he thought he detected a faint glow, as of moonlight, to their faces. There were a column of them now, robed like monks, their shining faces deeply shadowed. They moved in complete silence towards the house, and Detlef realised with a chill that they weren't displacing the grass and gravel as they walked. They trod on the air, floating a few inches above the ground, the cords of their robes trailing behind them. He was frozen to the spot, not with fear exactly, but with fascination, as if under the influence of one of that species of venomous serpent that chooses first to charm, then to bite. The window was open, but he did not remember unfastening it. The night air was cold on his face. The monkish figures floated higher now, feet above the ground, drifting upwards towards the palace. Detlef imagined sharp eyes glittering in their indistinct, half-seen faces. He knew, with a sudden burst of panic, that whatever these beings might be, they were here for a purpose, to visit him, to communicate specifically with Detlef Seok. He prayed to the gods he'd neglected, even to the ones he didn't believe in. Still the figures rose into the air. There were 10 or 12 of them, he thought, but perhaps more. Perhaps as many as 100 or 1,000. Such a crowd couldn't assemble in the gardens of the palace. But perhaps they were there despite all possibility. After all, men didn't float. A group of the figures came forward and hovered outside the window, barely out of Detlef's reach. There were 3, and the one in the centre must be the spokesman. This figure was more distinct than the others. Its face was more defined, and Detlef could mark out a forked black beard and a hooked nose. It was the face of an aristocrat, but whether a tyrant or a benevolent ruler, he could not tell. Were these the spirits of the dead, or demons of darkness, or some other variety of supernatural creature as yet uncatalogued? The floating monk looked at Detlef with calm, shining eyes and raised an arm. The robe fell away, and a thin hand appeared, its forefinger extended towards the playwright.
"Detlef Seok,"
said the figure in a deep male voice,
"you must go no further into the darkness."
The monk spoke directly into Detlef's mind, without moving his lips. There was a breeze blowing, but the apparition's robes weren't moving in it.
"You should beware."
The name hung in the air, echoing in his skull before it was uttered.
"Drakenfels."
Detlef could not speak, could not answer back. He was being warned, he knew, but against what, and to what purpose?
"Drakenfels."
The monk was alone now, his companions gone, and fading away himself. His body suddenly caught the wind and was twisted this way and that, coming apart like a fragile piece of cloth in a gale, and wafted away on the air currents. In a moment, there was nothing left of him. Covered in a cold sweat, his head hurting more than ever, Detlef fell to the floor and prayed until he fell into a swoon. When morning came, he discovered he had watered and fouled himself in fear.
Act 3. 1. It was a typical riverboat romance. Sergei Bukharin had travelled down the Erskoy from Kislev, an ambassador to the Empire from Tsar Radi Bokhar, overlord of the North. He joined the Emperor Luitpold just after the confluence of the Erskoy and the Talabek. Genevieve was immediately taken with the tall, proud man. He had won his scars championing the Tsar against the altered monstrosities of the northern wastes, and wore his hair and moustaches in long braids threaded with ceramic beads. He radiated strength, and his blood was richer than any she had tasted since her retirement to the convent. Aside from Henrik Krayli, Oswald's steward, Sergei and Genevieve were the only passengers on the Luitpold travelling the length of the Talabak to Altdorf. There was a glum and withdrawn elven poet who had come down from Kislev with Sergei and debarked at Talabheim. But he kept his purposes to himself and was shunned and mistrusted by Captain Iorga and his oarsmen. Of course, Genevieve was shunned and mistrusted too, but they seemed better able to deal with her condition than this alien, unknowable creature. At Talabheim,
The cabins were swelled by an influx of merchants, a pair of imperial tax collectors, and a major in the service of Karl Franz, who insisted on debating military matters with Sergei. Genevieve spent the long, slow days on the long, slow river, below decks, dreaming restlessly in her bunk, and her dizzying nights with Sergei, delicately picking off his scabs and sampling his blood. The Kislevite seemed to enjoy the vampire kiss, as most humans do if only they allow themselves, but was not otherwise all that interested in his deathless lover. When not in her arms, Sergei preferred the company of Major Jarl or Crayley. Genevieve had heard that the Tsar's people put little store by women in general, and vampire women in particular. There was the famous example of the Tsarina Catherine, who had sought the dark kiss and extended her reign over Kislev. A conspiracy of her great-great-grandchildren, frustrated at the block she represented to the dynastic succession, had led her to her well-merited assassination. The vampires of Kislev and the World's Edge Mountains were all like Vitzek, self-important, truly dead monsters, who at once looked down on humankind as cattle and feared the day-dwellers for their hawthorn and silver. She never pressed the matter with Sergei, but she guessed the brave warrior was a little afraid of her. That could well be the attraction for him, the desire to overcome a breath of fear. For her part, she was pleased to pass the dull journey, mile after mile of tree-lined banks and the eternal grunting and straining of the bonded oarsmen, with a strong taste in her mouth and a roughly handsome face to look at. By the time they were within a few days of Altdorf, she was already growing bored with her Kislevite soldier diplomat, and although they exchanged accommodation addresses, she knew she would never see him socially again. There were no regrets, but there were no really pleasant memories either. The Luitpold upped oars as it was hauled to the quayside between two tall-masted, ocean-going merchant ships down from the Sea of Claws with goods from Astalia, Norska, and even the New World. Sergei strode down the gangplank, saluted her from the docks, and marched off to court, presumably intending to stop off with Major Jarl at the first bawdy house along the way to remind himself of the feel of a real woman. To her surprise, Genevieve found a tear welling in her eye. She wiped the red smear away and watched her lover walk off with his friend.
"My lady," said Crayley, impatient now the trip was ended, "the Crown Prince's coach is waiting."
It was an impressive vehicle, and out of place on the malodorous docks of Altdorf, between the stacked-up goods and the dray carts. Liveried servants waited by the black and red carriage. The arms of von Königswald were picked out in green and gold. Crayley gave a dock worker a crown to carry Genevieve's luggage from the Luitpold to the coach. She refrained from mentioning that, for all her girlish appearance, she could best the emissary's bruiser in an arm-wrestling contest and pick up a heavy trunk one-handed. Genevieve bade a respectable farewell to Captain Iorga, who looked relieved to be rid of his half-dead passenger, but wasn't afraid enough not to suggest she book a return passage with him if she intended to go back to the convent in a month or so. After years in the convent, the scents and sounds of Altdorf were again a revelation. The Luitpold had pulled into the docks just after sunset. Torches had been lit to facilitate late workers, and Genevieve could smell, taste, and hear as well as any creature of the night. Here was the largest city in the Empire, indeed, in the known world. Built upon the islands of the Reich and the Talabek, but extending widely on the banks, Altdorf was a city of bridges and mudflats, surrounded by tall white walls with distinctive red tiles. Hub of the Empire, home of the Imperial Court and the Great Temple of Sigmar, and known, so the guidebooks say, for its universities, wizards, libraries, diplomats, and eating houses. Also, as the guidebooks omit to mention, its cutpurses, spies, scheming politicians, and priests, occasional outbreaks of plague, and ridiculous overcrowding. None of this had changed in 25 years. As they pulled into the city, Genevieve noticed that yet another layer of dwellings had been built upon the mudflats, creating a permanently wet, permanently unhealthy beehive structure in which the poor dock labourers, dwarf wall engineers, street traders lived in a distinct counterpoint to the fine houses of Altdorf's rich. There weren't many vampires because of the bridges. Witzak and his kind would have found themselves penned in on all sides by running water. Were she ever fully to die and become like them, one of the truly dead vampires, a walking corpse with an eternal bloodlust, she would have to avoid this city forever. For now, she drank in all the sensations, seeking out the pleasant scents of good Altdorf cooking and a ready-to-be-loaded cargo of herbs, and ignoring the mud, the rotting fish, and the sheer press of unwashed humankind. Left to herself, she would be glutted on blood tonight. But she supposed other arrangements had been made for her. A shame, for here there was life in the night. The crescent moon would be opening for business, and other taverns, the theatres, concert halls, circuses, gaming houses. All the rich, gaudy, rotten, beguiling pursuits of the living. The things which, in 6.5 centuries, Genevieve had been unable to put behind her. The door of the carriage swung open, and an elegant man got out. He was so simply dressed that for a moment Genevieve took him for another steward. Then recognition came. Oswald! The Crown Prince grinned and stepped forward. They embraced, and she heard again the call of his blood. She touched his bare neck with her wet tongue, connecting electrically between beard and collar with his life force. He broke the embrace and took a good look at her. Genevieve, my dear. It's so hard to get used to it. You're the same. It could have been yesterday. 25 years. To me, Highness, it was yesterday. He waved her formality away. Please, no titles. It's always Oswald to you, Genevieve. I owe you so much. Recalling herself unconscious and at the mercy of the iron-faced fiend of her dreams, she responded, Surely it is I who owe you, Oswald. I still live only by your sufferance. He had been a beautiful boy, with his golden hair and his clear eyes. Now he was a handsome man, with darker colouring, lines of character, and a man's beard. He had been slender and wiry, surprisingly strong and agile in battle, but still slightly awkward with a sword in his hand. Now he was as well muscled as Sergei. His body felt hard and healthy beneath his jerkin, and his tights revealed well-shaped calves and thighs. Oswald von Königswald had grown up. He was still barely a prince, but he looked every inch the elector he was soon to become. And his eyes were still clear, still bright with integrity, with emotion, with adventure. Impulsively, he kissed her. She tasted him again, and this time it was she who drew back, for fear that her red thirst would overwhelm decorum. He helped her into the coach. There's so much to tell, Genevieve, he began, as they trundled through the crowds of the docks towards the city thoroughfares. So much has happened. A street singer was performing by the Bridge of Three Towers, a comic song about a woodcutter's daughter and a priest of Ranald. When he sighted the arms upon the approaching carriage, he switched to the ballad that told of the death of Drachenfels. Oswald reddened with embarrassment, and Genevieve couldn't help but be a little satisfied to see his flush. This version of the tale was entitled The Song of Bold Oswald and Fair Genevieve, and imputed that the prince had taken on the great enchanter for the love of his long-dead lady. She wondered, not for the first time,
whether there had ever really been anything between them. Looking back on it, Genevieve supposed it would have been strange had they not fallen in love on the road to Castle Drachenfels. But in his terms, if not hers, that was half a life ago. Even Oswald was not about to present a vampire barmaid at court. When the bridge and the song were behind them, Oswald began to talk of his theatrical venture. "I have engaged a very clever young man. Some call him a genius, and some a damned fool. Both factions are right. But generally the genius outweighs the fool, and perhaps it is the foolery that fuels the genius. You will be impressed with his work, I'm sure." Genevieve allowed herself to be lulled by the creak of the wheels, the clap of hooves on cobbles, and the pleasant fire of Oswald's voice. The carriage was nearing the Altdorf Palace of the von Königswalds now. They were in the wide streets of the city's most exclusive area, where the mansions of the foremost courtiers stood in grounds spacious enough to accommodate a veritable army of lesser men. Smartly uniformed militiamen patrolled the streets to keep out the bad elements, and torches burned all night to light the way home for the weary aristocrat after a hard evening's toadying and prancing in the corridors of the Imperial Palace. Genevieve had not often been in this quarter during her century in Altdorf. The crescent moon was back near the docks, in a bustling, lively, dirty avenue known as the Street of 100 Taverns. "I'd like you to talk to Detlef Sierk, to give him the benefit of your recollections. You play a leading part, of course, in his drama." Genevieve was amused by Oswald's enthusiasm. She remembered him as a boy, declaring that were he not expected by his family to take the role of Elector after his father passed on, he would have chosen to be a travelling player. His poetry had won many plaudits, and she sensed that the grown man regretted that the demands of public life had prevented him from continuing to wield his quill. Now, by association, he would return to the arts. "And who, Oswald, is to play me?" The Crown Prince laughed. "Who else?" "Lily Nissen."
"Lily Nissen? That's ridiculous. She's supposed to be one of the great beauties of the age, and I'm
barely pleasing to look upon." "I knew that'd be your reaction. In Kislev, they say, beware the vampire's modesty. Besides, all is equal. I'm to be played by a dashing young genius who has broken more hearts than the Emperor's militia have heads. We are speaking here of the theatre, not of dry-as-dust historical tomes. Thanks to Detlef Sierk, we'll all live forever."
"My darling, I'll already live forever."
Oswald grinned again.
"Of course, I had forgotten. I might also mention that I have met Lily Nissen, and startling though she undoubtedly is, she cannot compare to you."
So, flattery is still considered an accomplishment at the court of the Emperor. The coach paused, and there was a rattling of chains.
"Here, we're there."
The great gates, inset with a wrought-iron von Königswald shield, swung open, and Oswald's coach turned into the wide driveway. There was some commotion up ahead, outside the palace itself. Trunks were piled high, and people were arguing loudly. An imposing, slightly overweight young man, in an elaborate and undeniably theatrical outfit, was shouting at a quavering coachman. Beside them, a dwarf was hopping from one foot to another. There were other outlandishly dressed characters present, all serving as an audience for the great-voiced shouter.
"What's this?" Oswald cried.
He clambered out of the still-moving coach and strode towards the knot of arguers.
"Detlef, what's happening?"
The shouter, Detlef, turned to the Crown Prince and fell briefly silent. In an instant, Genevieve felt the young man, the young genius, if Oswald was to be trusted, catch sight of her. She was leaning from the coach. They exchanged a look.
each was to remember for a long time thereafter. And then the moment was past. Detlef was shouting again.
I'm leaving, Highness. I don't need to be warned twice. The play is off. I'd rather be back in Munzen Keep than persecuted by ghosts. My company and I are withdrawing from the project, and I strongly suggest that you drop the matter yourself, unless you want to be visited by floating monks who speak without speaking and carry with them the odour of the grave, and a strong suggestion that anyone who defies them will be joining them in the afterlife.
2. Detlef had taken hours to calm down. But Crown Prince Oswald had spoken reasonably and at length, trying to put some less threatening interpretation upon the monkish manifestations. Ghosts can be petty, misleading even, and yet they are not known for their intervention in mortal matters. He waved an elegant hand in the air, as if conjuring the harmless spirits of which he spoke. The palace is old, haunted many times over. That was all very well, Detlef thought, but Oswald hadn't stared the deathly things in the face and been given direct orders by the dead. It is said that whenever a von Königswald draws near death, the shades of his ancestors return to bear him away with them. When the grandfather for whom I am named lay comatose with the brain fever, the noseless spectre of Schlichter von Königswald was seen, waiting implacably at his bedside. Detlef was unconvinced. He still remembered the ghost monk's piercing eyes and bony forefinger.
You'll pardon me for mentioning it, Ines, but in this case you seem to be in the pink of good health, while it is I, who can boast no relationship to your noble house, who has been placed under the threat of death.
A grave look came over the prince. Yes, Detlef, he said gently, but my father, the Elector. The Crown Prince nodded towards the corner of the room, in which the Elector of Ostland was coughing gently as he played with his toy soldiers, mounting an assault on the coal scuttle.
Hurrah for the General!
Cried Elector Maximilian. It must have been near his bedtime. Oswald looked at Detlef, and Detlef felt suitably chastened. The old man was indeed on the point of expiry. His mind had long since crumbled under the sieges of age, and his body was rapidly failing. But there was still the matter of the demon monks and their levitation tricks. A drink, Detlef? Detlef nodded, and Oswald poured out a generous measure of Istalian's sherry. Detlef took the goblet and ran his thumb over the embossed von Königswald shield. Here, in the warmth of a well-lit room, with the calm, unaffected Oswald and a battery of well-armed servants, the phantoms of the night seemed less menacing. If he came to think about it, the monks were far less impressive a manifestation than the tricked-up appearance of Drachenfels' demon pig servitors he was planning for the play. If it came to it, the afterlife could not compete with a Detlef Sirk production for supernatural spectacle. So, that's settled? Your production will continue? Detlef drank, feeling better. There was still something that troubled him, but he instinctively trusted the Crown Prince. Anyone who could walk alive out of the fortress of Drachenfels must have some experience with the unearthly. Fine. But I'll want you to detail some of your guards to watch over the company. There have been too many accidents, you know. Kozinski had broken his ankle, thanks to a carelessly anchored, or tampered with, piece of scenery. Geswoldo, the jester, had been struck down with a mysterious sweating sickness, and Varga Bruegel was having to read his lines in rehearsal. Someone had broken into Laszlo Lowenstein's rooms and shredded his collection of playbills, and every bit player and scene shifter was telling a spook story of some sort. The only thing that was running as expected about the production was that Lily Nissen was proving awkward and hiding in her rooms most of the time. She had expended more energy on fluttering her doubtless counterfeit eyelashes at Oswald than on learning her speeches. Detlef had heard of blighted productions before, and none could have been more thrice cursed than the history of Sigmar. but there were more tripwires and hidden pits along this route than he had a right to expect. And the company had not even made its way to Castle Drachenfels yet.
That might not be ill-advised, Detlef. We both have more than enough enemies in Altdorf.
Oswald summoned a servant and gave him brief instructions.
There'll be 20 men under the command of my trusted aide, Henrik Crayley, at the disposal of your company tomorrow. Your rooms will be guarded by night.
The servant hurried off. And I'll have your chamber exorcised by the priests of whichever god you favour.
I don't hold out much hope, though. This place is too old for exorcisms to take. It's been tried many times, I believe, and there are always new ghosts springing up.
There's a story about a bleeding child who trails his grave garments behind him, and there's the skull-faced governess who radiates an eerie blue light, not to mention the phantom dog who recites passages from Taradash.
Oswald seemed to warm to the subject and was displaying an unhealthy, childish relish in the dark history of his home.
There's no need to elaborate, Highness. I believe I appreciate the situation.
And our ghosts are as nothing to the ghosts of the Imperial Palace. The first Emperor Luitpold was reputed to have been witness to no fewer than 183 spectral manifestations in his lifetime, and Albrecht the Wise's hair was white before he was 30, thanks to the sudden apparition of a demon of the most frightful appearance, dressed in the uniform of the Imperial Guard.
"The General has triumphed again!"
shouted the Elector, holding high one particular lead hero.
"Eggs all round! Eggs for the troops!"
The old man's nurse quieted him down and led him away by the hand to his bedroom. Oswald was embarrassed, but clearly felt for his father's condition.
"You should have seen him as he was when I was a boy."
Detlef bowed slightly.
"Men are not responsible for their dotage any more than they are for their infancy."
There was a brief silence. The troubles passed from Oswald's face, and he turned to his other guest.
"And now you must meet the heroine of your piece, Genevieve Dieudonné."
The pale girl came forward, curtsied prettily, and offered her slim white hand to Detlef. He bowed to her and kissed her knuckles. She was cool to the touch, but didn't have the dead, slightly rancid appearance of the two other vampires Detlef had met. It was difficult not to think of her as the equal in age and experience of any of the young actresses and dancers Detlef had known in the theatre. She hardly seemed more than a year or two, at most, out of her schooling, ready to embark upon her first freedoms, fully prepared to be young. And yet she had seen 6.5 centuries go by.
"Enchanted," he said.
"Likewise," she replied. "I've been hearing about you. I trust that my reputation is in good hands with your quill."
Detlef smiled.
"I shall have to rewrite several speeches now that I have seen you. It would be unnatural for anyone to chance across such beauty and not remark upon it."
Genevieve smiled too. Her eye teeth were a fraction longer and sharper than a normal girl's would have been.
"Evidently, you and Oswald have studied bottom-kissing flattery under the same tutors."
The Crown Prince laughed. Detlef, to his surprise, found the bizarre woman charming.
"We must talk," Detlef said, suddenly keener on an interview. "Tomorrow, in the daytime, we could take tea and go through my text. It is still developing, and I would greatly appreciate your thoughts upon the drama."
"Tomorrow it shall be, Mr. Siak. But let's make it after sunset. I'm not at my best in the daytime."
3. His patron had done so much for him. It was about time Lohenstein did something for his patron. Even something as distasteful, dangerous, and illegal as grave robbery. Besides, it wasn't really grave robbery. The woman wasn't yet buried. His patron had told him she could be found packed in ice at the shrine of Mor. The corpse was awaiting the Emperor's coroners and Lohenstein's pleasure. The tall, gaunt actor passed through the door of the shrine, glancing up at the black stone raven that stood on the lintel, its wings spread to welcome the dead and those whose business was with the dead. Opposite the shrine was the Raven and Portal, the tavern favoured by the priests of Mor. The black bird on its sign swung in the wind, creaking as if squawking to its cousin across the way. Nearby were the imperial cemeteries, where the richest, the most lauded, the most famed were interred. In Altdorf, as in every city, Mor's town was the district of the dead. The man in the mask had smoothed Lohenstein's way considerably. A guard had been drugged and lay in the foyer of the low, dark building, his tongue protruding from a foamy mouth. The keys hung precisely where his patron had told him they would be. He had been in mortuaries before for recreational purposes and had no undue fear of the dead. Tonight, leather against his face, he had no undue fear of anything. He pulled the watchman out of the way so he could not be seen by any late passer-by. The shrine smelled strongly of herbs and chemicals. He supposed that if it didn't, it would stink of the dead. This was where those who died questionably were brought. The Emperor's coroners examined the bodies for traces of foul play or hitherto unlisted disease. It was a shunned place. Just to make sure, he felt for the watchman's heart. It was strong. He pinched the man's nostrils and put a hand to his sticky mouth until the beat was stilled. His patron wouldn't mind. Lohenstein thought of it as an offering to Mor. There were sounds outside in the night. Lohenstein pressed himself into the shadows and held his breath. A party of drunken revellers passed by, singing about the woodcutter's daughter and the priest of Renald. "Oh, my pretty lad, what you've done to me! My father will do with his axe to thee." One of them relieved himself loudly against the marble wall of the shrine, bravely cursing Mor, god of death. Lohenstein grinned in the darkness. The Soak would come to know the god eventually, as do all, and his curse would be remembered. Mor, god of death, and Shalya, goddess of healing and mercy, were the deities who really ruled the lives of men. The one for the old, the other for the young. You could placate the one or beg for the intercession of the other, but in the end, Shalya would weep and Mor would take his prize. Lohenstein felt closer to Mor than all the other gods. In the Nuln production of Taradash's Immortal Love, he had played the god of death and had been comfortable in the black robes, as he was comfortable now in the armour and mask of Drachenfels. Tonight, he could meet his patron mask to mask, he thought. He had kept his costume with him and worn the mask for his trip to the shrine. It served to shield his identity, but also he felt a strange ease when hidden behind it. 2 days ago, he had noticed horny ridges budding under the skin of his forehead, and felt a roughening of his normally sunken cheeks. He must have caught a touch of warpstone. The mask served to conceal his alterations. With the leather over his face, he felt himself stronger, more alive, more powerful. If his patron had given him this mission in Nuln, he would have been anxious, jittery. Now he was cool and decisive. He was changing, altering. The drunks were gone. The night was quiet.